Chapter 13, Company. My popularity, for all that it was, plummeted like a stone down a well, and I didn't know why. I did not imagine people more circumspect in my presence. They were. I sensed a general avoidance. No one phoned. I was reminded of a time surfing at Wollongong when the power of the waves sapped my strength and I'd not had the good sense to scramble to shore. I'd been caught in an undertow and had to be rescued. At Wilmeringle, I'd hit another cross-current. Even moments of spontaneous laughter at school were gone. Students were inexplicably subdued. There were times they looked upon me in that strange way of people who know some dark secret but nothing will loosen anyone's tongue. What was wrong? Were scholastic pursuits too mundane now? The timetable, prepared 5 weeks in advance as demanded by the Department of Education, followed prescribed curriculum. And though much of it was irrelevant for Wilmeringle children, motivation to learn had never been a problem. And there was evidence of progress. Most recently, evidence appeared inside the toilet, where four bare walls were filling with handwriting samples as students professed true love to each other and found an outlet for some very creative verse. Graffiti, it appeared, was inherent in every culture and only required the acquisition of skills for its expression. I had to be doing a good job. Why else would Aboriginal families leave settlements on the fringes of neighbouring townships to live at Wilmeringle? It was precisely as Bunny had hoped when he'd sold the school plan to the Aboriginals to inflate numbers. The school was established in terms of an enrolment which had soared to unimagined heights. The students cared. What would cause them to stop caring? As for their parents, or malcontents like Hogan, it was doubtful any movement targeting my hasty eviction could have escalated overnight. I was trying hard to complete a full year, to prove something to local doubters, to my father and to myself. It was a desperate battle, one I stubbornly fought alone. In vain I waited for word about a re-evaluation of the length of expected duty, but Inspector Bennett's comment about reducing the obligatory 3 years country service seemed to have died on his lips. His official report had been filed. The copy I'd received, quite praiseworthy and of some consolation, but it made no mention of a reduced term. A very real educational challenge has been met by the teacher with considerable initiative, assurance, and common sense, it read. I was performing a valuable service by raising cultural horizons and inculcating worthy social techniques and basic health habits. How well these complimentary phrases would serve me in the future was of little consequence. Ambition had no part in my present plans. I didn't aspire to be more than I was, to be in charge of larger institutions, to pilot the way for others, or to be anybody's disciple. For peace of mind, I couldn't risk coveting anything more than I had. I dared not seek further reward than the small bi-monthly allowance. Even in the Horville household, some conversations between Bunny and Dorothy tailed off when I entered the room, and Bunny's glances seemed suspiciously furtive. Still, nothing out of the ordinary was said, and I asked no questions. Sandy Blight made my life more miserable, my eyes like bloodied eggs, which erupted at the corners and spewed a lemony stream down each cheek. Compassion for such a common affliction could not be expected and wasn't given. But what was amiss? One day I received a penciled note from Mrs. Wallace, insisting that I fess up for something or another. The note explained Shirley being absent from school because she was suffering from stomach cramps. What was that supposed to mean? That same day, a dozen seedlings were planted along the school's eastern boundary with several children preparing the beds. When the last seedling was in the ground, I straightened on the spade and looked behind, and incredibly, there wasn't a plant in sight. All that remained in each carefully cultured square was a small hole. Since Valerie Orchard stood giggling, offering a handful of drooping plants to Blondie Cochrane, I presume she had sabotaged the project, and I was incensed. The bamboo cane had been gathering dust. The corporal punishment book awaited its first entry. In my wrath, I became trapped by ill-spoken words and eventually left myself no recourse than to punish the girl. I sent someone to fetch the dreaded cane. Valerie, her fright registering as a smile on her impish face, met me on the sand. Inflicting pain on her would be a monstrous undertaking. She extended her palm when ordered to do so. Her eyes brimmed with tears. My own seeped. I whipped the stick down, missing the first time and then catching her pink fingertips with a glancing blow. Around us, the children blanched in hardly respectful silence. We all sat then, heads bowed, while Valerie and Blondie replanted the entire crop of seedlings. We sat for a long time. I broke the cane into three pieces after that and staked three of the little trees with it. The hopeless grinding of life slowed further as Dorothy moved to Brewarrina to prepare for the arrival of her fifth child. The other Horville children went with her. Batching with Bunny became an ordeal in itself. Neither of us cooked well, and mealtimes became a test for survival. We worked our way through a gross of cabbage rolls in the first week, and then emu eggs three times a day through the second week. Emu eggs were palatable, but their enormity, the equivalent of a dozen hen eggs, created more omelette than either Bunny or I could stomach. "We only have one left," I mentioned glumly one morning as I bathed my eyes and Bunny sliced onion and both of us seemed close to tears. "Get the kids to help you find a few more," he ordered. "They're good to have when we have company." Company. It was ironic that within the infinite distance and isolated location, someone was always dropping by for a visit. Paddy O'Reilly on his way home in the middle of the night, a half bottle of scotch cradled in his arm to share in a friendly drink. A grimy kangaroo hunter named Harry Cram, the biggest liar I ever met, Bunny said of him, seeking a few provisions before returning to the scrub. Stock and station agents passing through, missionaries who had found their path, travellers who had lost theirs. Always the opportunist, Bunny welcomed these encounters. There might be a penny to be made selling petrol or groceries or in commission on the buying and selling of sheep. The chance to match wits and indulge in good fellowship animated him as little else could. Visitors were always offered a drink and a meal, and few would argue that Bunny was not a charitable man. At school, I raised the topic of snatching emu eggs, and we talked about the long-legged bird, how its inquisitive nature was its downfall, and how Aboriginal spear-throwers climbed trees and lured the birds close by whistling or swinging a ball made of bright rosella feathers. "Sir, sir," Darcy Shillingsworth demanded, and I unleashed him to scramble over the desk to the front of the room. Everyone sat up on cue. "Sir, me and get on with it, Darcy. Me and Ross and Sonny and my dad, we went emu hunting. Did you catch anything?" "Got the biggest emu you ever saw." "How did you get his attention, Darcy?" "Sir, my dad told me to lay down on your back and pedal your legs in the air. So I did. And the bird naturally came over to take a look." "Yes, sir." "Good story, Darcy. Thanks for sharing." I'd read that 40,000 emus had been slaughtered in Australia the year before, but I'd not known of any hunters who'd come to Wilmer Ingle other than Harry Cram. Aside from wrecking an occasional fence, emus were a great help when clouds of grasshoppers filled the sky. Dougie Orcher and Philip Yulo offered to lead me on an emu egg hunt, and after school that day we found ourselves moving stealthily across the flats, using saltbush croppings and spin effects as screens. Eventually, we squatted under a coolabah tree near a known emu nest. Dougie touched my arm then, something on his mind. "What you see?" he inquired seriously. Across the scorched earth, a wary female with long grey ruffles strutted in a wide arc like a sentry, stomping her clawed feet occasionally. I mentioned this, and Dougie explained the stomping was to warn intruders they were threatening her mate, who was taking his turn on the nest. The female's black eyes, like a camera's lens, never left our coolabah hideout. "What else?" Dougie asked pointedly. Nothing was distinguishable in the afternoon haze. Dougie was disgusted when I shrugged. He spent the next 5 minutes describing the presence of life written in the sand at our feet, the various droppings, a mole's hole, the print of a lizard, and the sweeping track of a snake, a sand swimmer, he called it. A porcupine was nearby, he said, burrowed in a dune, and he would get it later as it was better eating than emu eggs. The ants, he explained, indicating an endless black line passing between us and headed straight up the coolabah tree, were drawing nectar from leaf glands. Some were moving seeds. I looked nonplussed, and Dougie showed his frustration at my ignorance by standing and dusting his hands. Lesson over. Irritated, I said, yeah, well, what about dragonflies? The insect's present remained an unexplained sore point. Dougie's eyes revealed something, hurt perhaps. As he turned and ran into the open, he said, you figure it out. We drove the female emu off her course, whistling and yelling and flinging our arms in circles, and the male bird stood awkwardly, looked at the eggs, and then hobbled after her. We swept upon the nest, a circle of stones, sticks, and dried grass about 2 feet in diameter, and hovered over the spoils. There's 11 eggs, teacher, Dougie counted. How many you want? I put 4 dark green eggs inside my shirt and declined the offer of more. The boys took 2 eggs each. Mission accomplished, we looked to our separate paths home. But, on impulse, I asked whether anything was wrong at school. No, sir, Philip said, flashing brilliant white teeth. Dental care demanded little attention, since the Aboriginals' open-fire cooking meant burnt meat, and charcoal was an excellent agent for keeping teeth healthy. Dougie looked at the ground and didn't respond. I let the matter rest. Bunny's hurried note when I arrived home said he'd gone to Brewarrina, and would I please attend the telephone exchange and not give anyone credit on groceries. I boiled water and bathed my eyes before treating myself to a can of baked beans. To restore a little ego, I called the operator in Moree, and as her honeyed voice dripped through the wires, I was thankful she couldn't see the miserable state I was in. I promised faithfully to call on her when I'd bought a car. As I drifted towards sleep, my thoughts were on exactly that, buying some necessary independence in the coming August vacation, to be able to flee the restrictive environment any time I had to cut loose, to hell with everyone and their conniving ways. But the day had a final surprise. Psst! Are you awake? Something rubbed against my arm. Did I smell perfume? Wake up! A soft female voice urged. My eyes were slightly crusted. Someone was at the bedside. Someone was actually sitting on the bed. Who is it? I asked. What time is it? 3 o'clock. I studied the blurred profile against the mosquito mesh. Lucy O'Reilly? What was she doing here? Stroking my arm. Alarmed, I pulled the sheet up to my neck. I need petrol. Rubbish, you never needed petrol at 3 o'clock in the morning before. There was a bachelor's and spinster's dance down the Colgo. I thought you might have been there. I didn't know about it. I had no way of getting there anyway. Why hadn't I heard about the woolshed dance? I would have appreciated a night out, bloodshot eyes or not. There might have been some good food. It might have been a great opportunity to meet any single girls who hadn't moved to the city. I'd heard people travel great distances for these rare winter festivities. Had Bunny headed that way on his trip to town? Lucy's presence in the empty hovel home was no gloating matter. Regardless of the times I dreamed of such an apparition, this was a real quandary. What daring, I thought. What does she really want? What am I going to do? Don't put the light on, she cooed. No fear of that, I said. My legs began twitching. This young romantic I'd been warned about was a complication I didn't need at this time. We'd never met before. I wished we'd had a chance to meet on the tennis court as we discussed over the phone. She claimed to be the women's singles champion of the Northwest, but I was no slouch on the court myself. I had a wicked, if unorthodox, serve. I'd have given her a run for her money, but at least an encounter in broad daylight might have circumvented this predicament. A lot of people hoped to meet the Wilmeringal kid. There was a lot of talk about you, Lucy breathed. She'd been drinking. Damn! What a great night I could have had. My mind raced. I could still have a great night. And then I said, the Wilmeringal kid's not been himself lately. For one thing, he's blind. Relax, I won't hurt you. She threw back the sheet and her fingers traced down my neck. They were hot. I shivered. My straining eyes lit on something dazzling white and I realized I was staring at the cups of her brassiere. A considerable number of buttons had been undone for me to see that, I thought numbly. What rotten luck. Just when I had something worth seeing, I couldn't focus. Oh, it's hot in here, Lucy sighed, fanning my vacant stare with her blouse. I caught a glimpse of two cream puffs struggling to free themselves. I wanted to help them escape. It sure is, I agreed, showing some sensitivity at last as I pulled her down suddenly and tried to find her lips. My hand sought her breast and groped about, expanding and contracting of its own accord, transferring sensations to the rest of my body. This was a refreshing newness to them, which had so long been employed in trapping mosquitoes. The girl threw herself passionately against my chest and jammed my thumb and forefinger, sending a message of excruciating pain to my brain. I begged consideration of the consequences of further action as we wrestled with the blanket between us, and in a desperate lunge to find oxygen, I managed to crash our two bodies to the floor. There was a reluctant intermission. Chance was weighed against risk, conscience against passion. I felt obliged to say something in the awkward silence. "You must have a great forehand," I said. I stood shakily and smacked a couple of mosquitoes against my body, harder than necessary, and then, with a multitude of apologies, I padded out to get Lucy some petrol. She joined me at the bowser and sat in the car with the door open, her skirt raised well above her knees. One shameless leg lingered outside the driver's door. She chortled when excess gasoline began to spill over my feet. I stood back and saluted. She shook her head and drove off. A shooting star sped through the heavens. Was that a good sign or a bad sign? Could I tell good from bad if I saw it?